Hello and welcome to The Whole Health Cure, a space for trustworthy, science-based information on how you can live healthier and longer through the way you eat, move, think, and recover. I'm your host, Dr. Sharon Berquist, a physician, scientist, and lifestyle medicine pioneer with over 25 years of experience in patient-centered clinical care. Our conversation today is on the science of obesity and GLP-1 class of drugs, which include Wegovy and Ozempic for weight loss. And I am excited to have one of my dear colleagues joining me today, Dr. Jonathan Bonnet. John is a quadruple board-certified physician in family medicine, sports medicine, obesity medicine, and lifestyle medicine. He's an associate professor affiliate at Stanford University School of Medicine and the program director of medical weight loss at the Clinical Resource Hub Weight Management Center at the Palo Alto VA. Jonathan has a background in exercise physiology and is a certified personal trainer. He completed his undergraduate and medical school degrees at Ohio State University before finishing his family medicine residency at Duke University and a sports medicine fellowship at the University of Florida. He also holds a master's degree in public health from Harvard School of Public Health. He has co-authored two editions of the Lifestyle Medicine Handbook and the first edition of the Medical Fitness Bible. He has published research in sleep medicine, nutrition, sports and exercise, obesity, and behavior change, and serves on the editorial board of the American Journal of Lifestyle Medicine. John, welcome to the podcast.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Sharon. It's a delight to be here with you today.
So excited to have you and be able to have this conversation. I think you are one of the most broadly trained lifestyle medicine and just physician overall that I know. And I know you always add so much value to any conversation we have. So I'm excited to have you join today.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, I have lots of interests. I think it's probably the better way to put it. But yes, hopefully I can offer some good insight on some of these areas.
Well, it serves your patients very well. So John, how did you get interested in obesity medicine amongst the areas that you've been board certified in?
It probably wasn't my first area of interest initially. I mean, I think my first love definitely was exercise, and certainly I fell in love with that in undergraduate and almost ended up going to grad school in exercise physiology just because I thought it was a ton of fun, and I really enjoyed working with people trying to change and transform their lives, usually in a gym setting, but it was always sort of near and dear to my heart. I felt like medicine would sort of allow me to have other tools and resources beyond just exercise, and so it seemed to make sense to go down that road. And then my parents are both in sleep medicine. And so I always had that sort of as a background, which obviously led me ultimately to sports medicine and lifestyle medicine. But I think if you think about how to implement lifestyle medicine, I mean, there's certainly lots of good research on being able to use lifestyle medicine in many different chronic diseases. Obesity is the most prevalent, pretty much chronic disease we have in the United States, unless you're counting like osteoarthritis. So there's a huge, huge need for it. And I think the reason that I was drawn to it is that it really does employ all of the things that I love. So if you're really going to try and address weight, you really want to be thinking about an activity program, but you also need to focus on diet. But I think it even goes into all the other realms of lifestyle medicine. So if you think about, how a person's sleeping, how they're managing their stress, if they're using substances, if they have good social support and connection. I mean, I think obesity is one of the, I don't say obvious, but it's one of the diagnoses that patients almost intuitively get that, hey, if I'm going to work to change this, I'm going to have to make some lifestyle changes versus other conditions. There's not always, I think, that direct connection that's, is intuitive. And so it's nice that patients come basically with the expectation that, hey, I'm here. I want to work to change this. I know there's some things that, I'd like to work on with you, but, I'm here because, I've been struggling or had difficulty with it. So maybe it wasn't the first thing I said out, hey, I'm going to help with obesity medicine, but I think my love of, metabolism and exercise and how nutrition and diet and then really all the other ancillary factors go into it, it ends up becoming a pretty nice population where you can really implement all the different tools to really change somebody's life in a meaningful way.
And amongst the chronic diseases, I find that for obesity, I mean, it impacts probably the largest percentage of my patients, whereas I think the other chronic diseases certainly correlate with that, but a smaller subset of people are affected by some of the other chronic diseases. So it's such a common, almost universal challenge for people who are overweight or obese to lose weight, and for people who are not to prevent becoming overweight or obese as they get older. So I think it's something that affects all of us. And it's also, I think, one of the areas where in healthcare as physicians, we probably don't dedicate the resources nearly as adequately as I think we can. And, you know, sometimes the discussion is so oversimplified, just diet, exercise, and come back in 6 months. There's so much science behind obesity and how appetite is controlled, and that really, and you know, to the genetic level, et cetera, that speaks so much clearer to the struggle that people have. Can you give us a little background about just the science of obesity?
Yeah, no, I can definitely share with that. And you're right. I mean, it is a very common condition. I mean, if you look at the CDC's, the most recent statistics we have, which unfortunately keep getting worse every year, but it's about, you know, over 40% of adults over 20 are struggling with obesity. And it's almost 3/4 of the country now that is suffering from being overweight or having obesity. So, I mean, it's a huge, huge population. I mean, that's almost, it's almost everyone I can think of. So it makes it a really important challenge. And I think, you know, your question is a good one. I mean, our science and understanding are still evolving. I mean, I wish I could tell you very clearly how everything works and all the mechanisms and all the hormonal milieu that is involved. I mean, we've learned a lot. I think we probably have a whole lot more questions than we have answers at this point, which is, you know, true of any field. But I think fundamentally, you know, probably the easiest way to frame it, and so that, you know, people can sort of have a better understanding of at least how I think about it, probably still the common sort of accepted idea is the idea of this set point, which basically, based on your genetics and the environment you're in and the lifestyle choices that you're sort of making, your body basically finds a sweet spot. And so the analogy I'd use is like, you know, setting your thermostat at home. So you might put it on, you know, 70 degrees. And when you set it on 70, I mean, you might notice throughout the day that, you know, if it gets really warm and it's sunny in the middle afternoon, it might be 72, 73, 74. And then maybe at nighttime in the evening, it might actually cool off to be under 70 degrees. But on average, the thermostat's going to try and keep your temperature about 70. And so I think weight is a similar thing that you can think about. It's just that the inputs to the thermostat are quite complex. And so, you know, I think first order principles are, you know, well, it's all about what you put in your body. It's the calories in, calories out. I think we've probably get to that, but that's largely been sort of dispelled. Again, I think there's some caveats to that. But certainly, when you're thinking about all the things that go into weight management for somebody, I mean, diet and exercise obviously are big ones. Genetics are arguably the biggest piece of this. Although, again, if you look at how quickly the obesity rates have changed in the last 50 years, our genes are not changing that quickly at all. And so, again, the genes are sort of setting us up for it, but then the environment is really pushing a lot of people's, you know, genetic basis for having it into sort of full-blown fruition. And so, again, the genes are preparing you, but you still have to have the environment to really turn it on. But then I think about all the other things that go into this too. So those are the ones that I think most people intuitively sort of get. But then if you think about how is your sleep? And, you know, obviously we're a lot more sleep deprived probably than we used to be because of electricity and distractions. I think stress is a huge, huge, maybe one of the most overlooked ones. I mean, it's easy to say stress. It's really hard to measure the direct impact of that. I mean, we can actually see the hormonal transformation of a physical stressor into cortisol, which we know directly can negatively impact weight, particularly if it's over time and chronic and at high levels. So stress is, I think, one of the big ones. And I think, you know, we've had a lot of mental health issues in the United States as well. And so when you're thinking about depression or anxiety or PTSD and trauma that people have had, all of these things also feed into weight. And this is to say nothing about all of the other things that, you know, we get exposed to too, everything from the environment. I mean, there are many things that are now classified as, quote, obesogens, basically chemicals, compounds, or exposures that increase the propensity for somebody to gain weight or become obese. So there's probably thousands of these things at this point. We don't have the data to know it necessarily, but there are lots of things that are beginning to be implicated in the process. So when you think about those, there's lots of things that get wrapped into it. Obviously, medications cause, you know, many of the problems that we're trying to fix. So we have medications, which we're going to get to, that can help, you know, facilitate, you know, weight control and weight loss. But many of the medications we're using, ironically, to treat these conditions that have arisen in modern day with depression, anxiety, and PTSD and diabetes and everything else, actually feed in that process and make the obesity process worse. And so now you not only have one underlying health condition that's driving excess body weight, but now we're adding medications to fuel it to actually put more calories into the system, which really we don't want. So when you think about all the different things that are going into it, I mean, I've only listed a handful of them, and we're just learning about things like the microbiome or the circadian rhythm or how these other sort of more nuanced things impact weight, it becomes quite complicated very quickly. So again, I think we're looking at first order principles when we're thinking about treatment management, but there's no question it's an incredibly complicated disease. And I think we're still sort of at just the cusp of understanding some of the fundamentals of it.
And do these factors all impact set point, or are they some of them impacting weight and others impacting set point?
Yeah, so great question. So the way I think of the set point is the culmination of all of these things together. So for example, if I took somebody and we said, hey, we're going to start a new exercise program tomorrow. Previously, they may be a sedentary person or they may not be doing much activity. So once you add in physical activity, it's now going to interface with the homeostasis of the system. It probably is going to drive it a bit lower. I mean, we can talk about it, but general physical activity probably helps people lose about 4 pounds. It's not tremendous, but it still does exert influence over that sort of set point of weight. And so when I think about all these other things, you know, I have a nice picture of a thermostat with all these different factors listed around it. You basically want to think of them as levers you can pull, right? So for many people, some of them they might be excelling in or doing great in, and other of them they might not be doing as well in. And so when you're thinking about, well, how can I help this person? Their obesity is probably driven by a combination of all of these things. So a lot of times it's not just one magic thing that you have to do. I mean, if you said, hey, I'm just going to focus, you know, strictly on the diet, you have to realize that there are underlying emotions, stressors, other things that are going into appetite control. So even if they're consciously trying to make good, healthy choices, if they have an undercurrent of all these other factors going into it that's making healthy choices really difficult, or just changing their hunger drive, you're still sort of one step behind where you actually need to intervene to sort of correct that process. But in terms of the set point, the way I think about it, you find basically a weight given all of the other factors, whatever they are, when they're in a static position. So if you're exercising constantly, your body's going to find a set weight. And let's for the sake of example, let's say it's 200 pounds. With whatever you're doing currently, this is the weight that you are. You basically have optimized for that weight given the environment that you are in, the behaviors that you're currently doing, and the genetics that you have. So if you're going to change that set point, one of those things must change. So genetics, we can't really change our genes very easily, so that one's kind of out. But environmentally, again, we have a little control over that, probably not as much control as we think, right? We don't control the food environment we have. We don't control the physical activity environment we're in. We don't control our jobs. There's lots of things we cannot control in the environment, and that's probably the public health discussion we can have about obesity. But then you have the behavioral piece. So there are behaviors that you do have some autonomy over, and so many times that will be the focus of it. But until you're addressing one of those things, the weight will not change. As soon as you address one of them, you will get some movement in the set point. Now, the only way you can keep the set point at a different spot than it originally was is to continue to do that behavior. And this is going to come up with basically everything we talk about. Diets work when you're on them. They don't work when you're not on them. So if you lose weight while you're on a diet, that's wonderful. If you stop doing that diet, again, that sort of lever that you're pulling is disappearing. And so the general tendency will be to slowly regain weight back to where you were before, given if you're eating the same that you were prior to doing the weight loss, you know, initially. So I think that's one of the nuanced things, is that weight is not just a static thing you arrive at, is it is a continuously changing balance and homeostatic proposition that moves over time.
John, that's such a conceptually important point that I think is actually, as you're saying, the crux of what doesn't get communicated, because the goal is really to lower your set point as opposed to, quote, lose weight. Because once your set point is close to where, you know, you'd like it to be, maintaining weight actually is much easier. And if you have to keep struggling, your set point has not been lowered. So for example, if a person's set point, let's say, was at 180 pounds and they, you know, try and lose weight eating half a pizza instead of a whole pizza, let's just say, the saturated fat, you know, the components that drive the set point haven't been lowered. So the body wants to go back to that higher set point, back to that weight and regain that weight. Whereas what you're talking about is this set point is, so this thermostat is adjustable. How do we lower the thermostat so it's not so much of a struggle to take the weight off and then keep it off? Is that a good framework for thinking through this?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great way to look at it. I think the only thing I'd add is that, I mean, weight loss is difficult. I'm not here to say this is easy, but I also would say for the majority of people, weight maintenance actually becomes quite difficult too. I mean, if we could just wave a magic wand and truly change the set point, that would be perhaps different. I think the challenge is the set point really is contingent on all of these other factors. And so whenever we change one of them, we're going to get, you know, a concomitant adjustment of the set point. But that adjustment is only going to last for as long as that thing remains changed. So if we, you know, do the diet and exercise intervention, that will change our weight. Hopefully we'll lower it. But you have to keep doing that diet and exercise intervention to then keep it there. And again, you only get so much movement. It doesn't just perpetually go down, which is the frustrating part and why many people, as you're trying to lose weight, they will be very motivated. They'll start the program. They'll be losing weight. They'll be doing great. Eventually, they'll sort of plateau and they'll be a little stagnant there. They're still doing exactly the same things they were doing before when they were losing all this weight. So it becomes quite frustrating to still be exerting all this effort, but to not be seeing the results they're expecting to see on the scale. So typically after that happens for a handful of weeks or a month or however long the person's sort of willing to tolerate that, they sort of end up throwing in the towel almost of saying, I don't understand, I'm working so hard, I'm not getting the results I want, why am I even working this hard? And when that happens, then there is that gradual climb back up, which I think that's why it's made this disease so, so complicated, is because the underlying genetics and the way we were built, we are designed to hold on to weight and to not lose it. And I think the other challenge is people are trying to do their best, particularly with lifestyle changes, your body is downward compensating your own metabolism. So as you are cutting out calories, as you are trying to burn more fat, your body recognizes that it is in an energy deficit. So it does not have enough fuel to keep doing all the things it normally does. Now, in the beginning, if there's a lot of extra fuel around, it's not too finicky about it. But the longer you do it and the more you sort of press on the gas of trying to lose weight, the lower it turns down your own metabolism. So you basically get in this really, really terrible sort of between a rock and a hard place where you are dieting and exercising so, so hard, but now your metabolism has slowed down so much that even despite all of your best efforts, the scale is not moving anymore because you've cut your calories so much that your body is basically running as efficiently as it possibly could without all that extra energy. And so that's where you really run into the challenges of, well, how am I going to keep all this weight off if I'm basically stuck having to do this really, really intense exercise program indefinitely?
I think that's a scenario so many people can relate to. What would you advise people to do if what they did is not working as effectively as anymore as they're getting closer to their goal weight?
We have weight plateaus all the time in our clinic. I mean, it is part of the process. It is not an unexpected design. And really, if you're doing a good job losing a weight, like it is going to be something that everyone will deal with at some point. When they happen, there's a couple of things that I can suggest. I'm not sure if I have a magic solution here, but basically it's a really good time to sort of go through a thorough evaluation of what you are doing, right? And so you can say, well, hey, has my diet slipped a little bit? Have I gotten a little lax here? Have I, you know, missed some workouts? Am I overly stressed right now? Maybe this is not the time to push the pedal to the metal and really try and wait to, you know, focus on weight loss. There may be other things in life going on that are going to take priority. So I think it's okay to give yourself a little grace and say, hey, you know what? Like I've worked really hard to get here. I need to pause for a little bit. Maybe I will back off some and then sort of reevaluate on what areas you might have. One, you could either reevaluate what you might have laxed or come down a little bit on in terms of how much time and effort you were putting in. Or you might decide, hey, you know what? There's this other thing. I'm still doing equally well, but you know, I want to try and lose more weight. So I'm willing to put even more effort into what it was I was doing before. I think if none of those work, then I think you really want to start to think about, well, okay, why do I want to lose weight? Like, what is my overall goal here? Is it specifically for health? Is it just for me? Is it a cosmetic thing, which is a totally reasonable thing to do? Or is it there's some other underlying thing that, you know, I think I'm going to be at risk for that. I think if I don't lose weight, I'm going to be in trouble. And then I think at that point, if you really have exhausted all of the lifestyle things, you're doing everything you possibly can, it's a totally appropriate time. If you still need to lose weight for health reasons, then you may consider other options as well.
And we viewed this as cutting back on calories, and obviously the metabolism slows when you do that. If a person, instead of strict calorie restriction, does intermittent fasting and does the metabolic switching, for our listeners between using glucose for energy versus using fat for energy in the fasted state. Does the metabolic switching have a different impact on metabolism than continuously restricting calories?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I'll start with just my sort of dietary spiel here, which I think is really helpful framework for people understanding what might work, how it's working, why it's working, maybe what to do. What I will say is there seems to be a lot of individual variability here. So I can tell you some people have done amazing with intermittent fasting. People have literally lost no weight doing that and felt very frustrated by it. People do wonderful on lower carbohydrate diets. People do terrible. So again, I think it really is much more about the individual than it is of there is this one single thing that everyone should be doing. And if everyone just did this, then I think you find success. What I will say from the diet standpoint, and this is the best framework I can offer, is that anybody who's trying to doing to lose weight through some sort of dietary intervention, every single diet that you can come up with that's ever been published, there's a book on, a news article on, it does one of three things. And so it either reduces calories overall, so just total calorie reduction. You don't have to change what you eat. You just have to eat less of everything. So this is calorie counting. This is Weight Watchers. That is the simplest way to just try and say, hey, I'm going to go on a diet. I'm just going to eat less of all of the same things. So that's one option, which is sort of what we were talking about a little bit. Option number two is to say, I'm going to limit the kinds of things I eat. Now, this is where most of the diet books exist and are around, but you can literally pick your favorite evil ingredient of the day, whether that's gluten or carbs or fat or Whole 30, fill in the blank. Every single diet will pick some sort of rules to set that says you just have to get rid of this thing, white foods, whatever it ends up being. And so that's another big component. Now, again, anytime you're going to remove foods, in theory, if it's a food that you typically eat, you are probably ultimately going to end up reducing calories. It's just you're sort of changing the way that you're looking at the problem because you're just saying, well, if I just avoid, I mean, carbohydrates are an easy example. If I just avoid carbohydrates, you know, I'll lose weight. And if you eat 50% of your diet, like the average American is from carbohydrates, well, if you cut out 50% of your food, you are probably going to lose weight. You are still cutting calories, by the way, but you are just choosing a very specific kind of niche that seems like it's going to work for you. So this works well when people have specific problem foods or challenging areas. I think there are some people who do respond better to certain kinds of dietary restriction. I mean, we certainly know people with IBS respond much better to like a low FODMAPs diet. Obviously, if you have a gluten sensitivity, a gluten-free diet is something that you're going to have to do. Lots of people have dairy insensitivities, so a lactose-free diet would be a good option. That's number two. And honestly, most of the different diets that people come up with are usually some form of number two. There's just one evil ingredient that caused all your problems, get rid of it, and then you'll be cured. The last one is to change not necessarily how much you're eating or the kinds of food you're eating, but when you are eating, which is really the intermittent fasting kind of idea. So it doesn't say I'm purposefully cutting my calories or I'm avoiding any certain foods, but I'm only going to eat foods between 10 a.m. and 4 p.m. And again, you can pick your window here, but some concept of restricting the window with which you eat. And again, if you restrict the window narrow enough, I mean, most people are unable to eat a sufficient amount of food in just a single meal again and again and again. So if you get that restrictive, again, it's a different way you're sort of overall reducing your intake. But for some people, it might be more favorable. It might be easier to adhere to. What I can tell you is that most of the diet literature that is out there, it basically says there are some people who do really awesome on some diets. There are people who do really terrible on the exact same diets. The average weight loss is probably, again, pretty comparable between many of the approaches. The best thing that predicts if you're going to do really well is how well you stick to that diet. So you can pick your favorite poison, whatever it ends up being, but it needs to be something that you love, that fits into your lifestyle, that you can do for a really long time. If those things are true, it's probably going to work for you. And I will say the converse of that, anything that you are only going to be able to do for a couple of months is not going to give you sustainable long-term weight loss. So you can fill in the blank of whatever that diet looks like, but if this is not something you see yourself being able to do for a minimum of 6 months, a year, 2 years, like a long, long time, I would probably rethink what that dietary approach is going to look like and see if you can modify it in a way that would be appealing to you.
Yeah, that's a really, really good framework for thinking about it. And the exercise piece, I want to go back to when a person has been losing weight and then hits a plateau, the exercise, you know, a lot of people walk maybe low to moderate intensity, but don't necessarily do the level of intensity for building muscle mass. Is there a way to break through that plateau by changing exercise? And what would you recommend people do from the exercise standpoint?
The exercise piece is interesting, but I will say, is a pure weight loss mechanism, it is not going to be as effective as diet is in terms of just helping people lose like weight on a scale pretty convincingly. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find someone who doesn't think that diet plays a bigger role than activity in weight loss. When you're thinking about an exercise program, from a weight management standpoint, again, you're thinking probably about overall energy balance. And so ironically, with activity, a lot of times it's just increasing overall volume. And so not necessarily trying to get to the medium and highest of intensities, which by definition, you're not going to be able to do very long. I mean, I think there's a myriad of health benefits and there's plenty of reasons why you'd want to incorporate moderate and vigorous intensity throughout your day or throughout your week for many, many health reasons. But I think if your goal is purely weight loss, I think one, the focus would be on doing things that aren't going to cause injuries. Many people who are struggling with overweight or obesity have a lot of joint issues and joint pain. So overuse and being able to do too much ends up actually being a problem. But from a pure energy standpoint, you're actually going to burn far more calories doing stuff around the house, like low to moderate intensity activity, walking for a long time. One, because many of these people may not have the conditioning to do the higher intensity stuff, and it may not be as safe. But two, again, if you're doing high intensity stuff, I mean, you're going to be pretty wiped, and you're actually not going to burn tons of calories overall because the duration of it is so, so short. So you actually want to work to increase just the overall amount. And I think the fitter you get, the more you can incorporate those other things. And I think the more you can do things like resistance train and incorporate some high intensity stuff, it definitely is a very strong stimulus to help keep on lean muscle mass, which is one of the important things in keeping your metabolism really high. People who just do diet without the exercise component often run into that struggle of, I'm cutting calories so much, but I'm not losing any weight anymore. And again, your metabolism has really cranked itself down along with your calorie reduction. So you really are kind of stuck. But I think exercise is a great way you can sort of burn additional calories on top of it. It probably also will make you feel better and give you a lot of energy. But again, it sends probably the strongest signal of telling your body, hey, don't get rid of our skeletal muscle. We need that. So I think for that reason, you definitely don't want to forego doing it. And I think the other point I would offer just about the exercise as a whole, even if it's not the best tool for weight loss, I'm pretty convinced it's one of the best things you can do for weight maintenance. So after you've lost weight, if you want to stay at that new weight, exercise is pretty good at helping as an overall appetite suppressant. The other thing I love if you can incorporate resistance training is that if you finally get to that point where you're leveling off and all of a sudden you are adding back calories in because your body is telling you you're hungry because you've lost all this weight, and that's exactly what your body is going to do. If you're doing resistance training, you can have a perfect opportunity to build some muscle mass. And you can build muscle mass no matter how old you are. I mean, if you're over 90, you can still build muscle mass. You're never too young and you're never too old to do that. So that to me is like an opportune time to implement that sort of intervention because you probably are going to have some extra calories just as your body gets sort of used to being where it was. Your scale weight probably is going to go up a little bit. So I think people just need not to be too afraid of that. But I think as long as you're putting in the good stimuli of resistance training, weightlifting, you're going to find that your body's going to use it to build muscle, which is super good for your health. And for it also, you know, in general, people care about the visual appearance and how they look. Muscle is much denser than fat. So at the same weight, if you are go from, you know, 20% body fat to, I don't know, 15% body fat, even if you weigh the same amount or even weigh more on the scale, aesthetically, people will claim that you, quote unquote, you know, look better because you're a much smaller figure, because muscle, again, is much denser. And again, metabolically, you're never going to really have any harm if you're adding muscle mass because it's super good for all of the other underlying metabolic functions and glucose disposal and everything else. I'll leave that. I'll get off my resistance training soapbox.
I think that's very helpful because I think we tend to not be very prescriptive about what the exercise piece looks like. So I think that was actually very helpful. I want to switch over to talking about weight loss medication and specifically GLP-1, glucagon-like peptide 1. Most people just say Wegovy or Ozempic, but of course there are other brands. You manage a lot of people on medication. I have increasingly been doing so as well in our primary care practice. Can you talk a little bit about what you think the role of medication is and then this particular class of drug?
Yeah, they're definitely the hot topic nowadays. Unfortunately, I'm not sure how I want to look at it, but yeah, I've got a lot of experience. I mean, so I work in a weight management center, and so we are a referral site for the VA primary care physicians to send us patients who are struggling with overweight or obesity. So we tend to get more complicated cases of obesity. And so pretty much everyone who has come to us has already gone through the gamut of multiple different diets. The VA has its own MOVE program, which is sort of like a diet and exercise intervention. And so when we get patients, they have already gone through a lot of different attempts at trying to lose weight. So this is not the first or someone who just says, hey, you know, I'd like to lose weight. You know, I heard about Ozempic. I want to try it. Who really hasn't sort of gone through some of the other things first. So I would just throw it out there that medications are great and they can be really good for certain people, but it's definitely not the first thing you want to do if you really haven't given it a true attempt at some of those other things first. Now, having said that, I think medications can be a wonderful option for some people. And I think they are the best option for certainly the patients that I see, just like I think bariatric surgery can be a useful tool for the right people. Again, I think you want to be purposeful about who you are and if the benefits truly outweigh the risks. But again, they're a tool just like anything else. So you mentioned, so GLP-1s, they're a new class of drug. They were actually designed as a diabetes medication. So the primary function that they got studied for was they basically, when somebody eats food, the gut essentially increases the amount of insulin that is secreted immediately after a meal. So it actually helps increase the amount of insulin transiently to help lower blood sugar more quickly. So the idea was you give this agent, it helps lower blood sugar down. So people with diabetes don't have high blood sugars and they're able to maintain a better glucose balance overall. Now, it turns out it does some other things too. So in addition to that slight increase of insulin, it lowers another hormone, glucagon. And so insulin and glucagon sort of work in reverse. Insulin sort of tells your body to store fat. Glucagon sort of tells your body to burn fat. They're sort of in opposition to one another. But the other things it does too, though, it slows how quickly food leaves your stomach. So when you eat something, you actually feel fuller much longer. And so this is a lot of the appetite suppressant effect because it doesn't take as much time to exit out of your stomach and actually slows how quickly it moves through your intestines. So it's basically kind of slowing down that whole digestive process. But we also know it acts on the brain. So it does seem to also operate on the appetite centers. So it just decreases food drive as well as thirst too. So it's doing a bunch of different things all at once. And you know, I think one of the sad things to say with there's five FDA-approved weight loss medications. Semaglutide is one of them. Wegovy is the brand name for it. But of those five, there's only one of them. I think we really have a very clear understanding of how it works, what it's doing, how it's doing, and why it's doing it. All of the other ones, including the GLP-1s, I don't think we truly actually know. We understand mechanistically some of the areas it's working, but we're not totally sure which one of those things it's doing the most. It seems to be working, but we also don't have like crystal clear understanding of how it works.
I think that's very relevant because a lot of questions I get about weight loss medications is, are they safe? So there's a role for them, but you have to weigh that with the safety and likelihood of long-term success from the weight loss. And this is where the mechanism comes in of how they work. And if we knew, because a lot of people ask me, is it just going to make me eat less? And if I did that on my own, would I get the same result? Looking for, of course, a safe way to lose weight. The safety issues, and you know, there's just very recently news reports of stomach paralysis with this class of drugs. Have you encountered problems with side effects?
Definitely. I will premise that, I mean, pretty much any medication can have side effects, and this one's certainly not immune from them. Although, you know, anything you do has the potential to have side effects as well. I mean, you can go out for a run and get hit by a car too, which is certainly not a good thing. Hopefully much less likely than side effects from medications. But I think with medications, and particularly with the GLP-1s, there does seem to be a very high propensity of side effects with them. I mean, even their own package insert, and I can tell you this clinically, and I'll tell you the package insert, and I'll just say what I typically see with patients. But many of their own package insert says about 44% of people, so almost half of the people who take the medications are going to get nausea. Now, some people might say that's actually a feature of the drug versus a side effect, because if you feel nauseated, you actually don't feel hungry. So, you know, you could say that's a good thing or not good thing. But I mean, it clearly is impacting your GI system. And so obviously we're giving a medication at a much higher dose than is what's normally there physiologically. Native GLP-1 is only around for seconds to minutes. And so this drug has a half-life of a week. So when you take one dose of semaglutide, it's going to be hanging around for almost 5 weeks until it's completely gone. So it is a much higher dose that's much more durable. Now, because of that, you're going to run into some other issues too. So I think the common one that you typically see here, nausea is definitely the most common. Usually happens within the first 72 hours if you're going to get it with any dose. Typically gets better over time. So the longer you're on it, that actually does get better, which is a good thing. Constipation seems to be really high. That's not necessarily the package insert, but it's probably 3 or 4 on the list. But I would say many, many people struggle with constipation. I think that's a combination of the drug itself, but also just, I mean, marked decrease in food intake as well as water intake. So constipation usually is treatable with increased fiber, increased water. Occasionally you have to use, you know, a fiber supplement or something like that. Some patients actually get the reverse though. They get diarrhea. Doesn't make a lot of sense if you have a drug that's giving diarrhea and constipation to some people. They seem like opposite mechanisms. So I'm not sure if I can explain that one, but I mean, I've had patients had acid reflux bad enough that they have to discontinue it. So just bad enough heartburn, burping, things like that, that they actually have to stop it. So those are probably the most common ones I see in the GI system. And then I think the more worrisome ones that you're probably alluding to a little bit. So gastroparesis, or the slowing of the stomach, again, almost a feature of the drug because it makes you feel fuller longer. But for people who do have a slow emptying system, it can cause to go too slow. And too slow is actually a problem because then you have things that get stuck and lodged in there, and that can be problematic. So you definitely don't want that to happen. But again, if you're somebody who's at risk for that, we typically would avoid the agent in somebody like you. Although, again, there's many people who don't know that necessarily unless you're getting a bunch of GI tests done. But then the other sort of, you know, more concerning side effects that we've potentially seen with this, or at least there are some reports of it, would be something called pancreatitis. So there does seem to be an increased risk of these drugs with pancreatitis. So we typically will not prescribe them to people who have had pancreatitis unless the cause is known and treated. So like if you had gallstone pancreatitis and got your gallbladder taken out, then we'll typically still consider using it if it's appropriate otherwise. Same thing if it's alcohol pancreatitis, you know, if you're not drinking anymore, you know, again, something we could consider. If they don't know why you had pancreatitis, then we would typically want to avoid it just because, again, there does seem to be an increased risk of that. And then I think the other big ones, you know, that have been at least mentioned, there was concern in rat studies that there's an increased risk of something called medullary thyroid cancer. It's a pretty rare thyroid cancer. That's about 3 cases per million adults in the US each year. The data they've done in humans is not convincing, although the French study reported about a 1.5 times increased risk. So this would be going from 3 people per million in the US per year to 4.5 people per million per year. So there may be something there, and you know, certainly we want to pay attention to that. So I think that would be the other one. And then the last one is patients who have diabetes, if they have an eye condition called retinopathy, for some reason, this may actually worsen that condition in the short term. Again, we have no idea why, because if anything, you're improving the health of the eye and the health of someone with diabetes. So I'm not sure if I have a whole lot to say on that one, but those are probably the biggest, the red flag risks, and then also just the more expected ones are in the GI system. So I basically tell everyone, expect to get some nausea with this. You're pretty lucky if you don't. And if you don't get it at the early doses, you're probably going to get it once you get up to a high enough dose.
And amongst the different medications in the whole family of GLP-1 agonists, is there one that, or some that you find are more effective for weight loss than others? And what's a typical weight loss on these medications?
Yeah, great question. So one of the reasons that these medications have gotten popular, I'll give you just a quick overview of all the ones and then we'll focus on the GLP-1s. But I mean, historically, you know, 5 to 10% of clinical weight loss was sort of the goal for most of these things. And the approval for the FDA is usually at least 5% body weight loss with the agent. So most of the oral agents that we have probably are in that ballpark. So there are a couple of other ones. There's a bupropion naltrexone. Again, 5 to 10% weight loss probably. Phentermine topiramate, probably in the 8 to 10%. Those are both oral options. And then the injectable options would be liraglutide, which is a daily version. It's a GLP-1 too, just kind of like a sister medicine of semaglutide, but it is a daily medication versus a weekly medication, which is semaglutide. Liraglutide weight loss is probably 6 to 10%. So it's a little bit lower. It's still not that different. For some people, they do seem to do well, but it's not as impressive as the semaglutide is probably around 15% body weight. So it's basically 50% to 100 or 200% as good as the oral agents we had previously. And then tirzepatide is not approved yet, but that's a GLP-1 GIP, if we didn't have enough alphabet soup for you. But that one weight loss is, you know, a little over 20%. So in terms of the weight loss with the semaglutide itself, on average, semaglutide is the best agent based on all the data. And I'd say clinically on average it is. But I mean, I tell this to all my patients too, is that, I mean, I have plenty of patients who lose zero weight on semaglutide. So semaglutide, which is also just framing it out there, semaglutide, Ozempic, and Wegovy, they're basically all the same thing. Ozempic is the diabetes version. Wegovy is the brand name weight loss version. It is the same drug from the same manufacturer. So it's all semaglutide. It's all a GLP-1. So if you're confused about which pen you're getting, the dosing is slightly different, but the drug is exactly the same. But I will say some people do respond better to some agents versus others. So I have some people who've done much better on the oral medications and who lose, you know, 15, 20% of their body weight on those. Again, these are all in conjunction with lifestyle. These are not dosed alone. In fact, the package insert actually requires you to prescribe it in combination with a comprehensive lifestyle program. So again, these are all done on top of other things you should be doing as well along with them. So I think that's just another important point to highlight. The other thing that came with the semaglutide, and one of the reasons it got so much buzz, was not just because on average there's a little bit more weight loss, but the other thing, when they do research studies, they give you the average, but the average doesn't tell you the whole story, because there are people who about 8% of their own research study cohort basically lost almost no weight. So that's 1 in 10 people who are taking this, probably aren't going to lose much weight at all. And then you have the other end of the spectrum, basically a third of the patients who took it lost more than 20% of their body weight. And the reason why that would matter is that when people have bariatric surgery, which to date is the most, I don't know if success is the right word, but in terms of resulting in the most weight overall from an intervention, I mean, surgery typically is still number one. But for about a third of the people who take semaglutide, again, you're basically getting comparable results to having a bariatric surgery, depending on which procedure you pick and things. So that's really exciting to have a drug that is almost as good or, you know, comparable to having an irreversible surgical procedure. And I think tirzepatide is even more exciting because it's about another, it's basically a one phase shift of the results for semaglutide. So instead of 15%, it's 20%. It's like a third of patients losing more than 25% of their body weight and half patients losing more than 20%. So it's an even more impressive in terms of overall weight loss. So now we're talking about pretty big numbers. And I mean, at some point, the medications basically are going to be comparable or better than surgery, which is why I think there's been so much attention given to this because, oh, wow, like for some people, I mean, this is a life-changing medication. So I think in the right people, it's really good. But again, I think it comes back to the right person is not everyone. So I think figuring out who that is a bit more challenging.
That's been my experience as well. I've had patients who have called me back and said, this is a, quote, miracle drug. I've never felt the same as myself this way since I've been on it. And then I've had some who have had zero weight loss. And my last question, John, is getting people off of the medication. So as people get closer to their goal weight, and for people who want to gradually start to wean off, what is your experience and advice with getting off of these, if, or do you not recommend it?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. We don't have convincing data to tell you exactly what to do here either. I mean, these trials were basically just done a couple of years ago. The concerning things that they have published is that all the people who did this trial, and with semaglutide anyway, and lost all this weight, you know, 15, 16%, you know, a third of them losing more than 20% of their body weight. After the trial ended, they basically stopped the drug, right? Because you're out of the research study. It's not FDA approved yet, but they still follow the people to see what happens. And so basically at the end of a year, the take-home line was, you know, two-thirds of the weight was regained, meaning that of all the weight that all of the participants lost, they only maintained about a third of the weight loss overall. Now, I think there's an important caveat here of that's the averages, which again, averages are helpful and useful. But if you look at who actually kept the weight off, it basically, all of that weight that was still off was only from the participants who lost more than 15 or 20% of their body weight to start with. So if you went on this drug, lost no weight, you actually maybe ended up a little bit higher than you started. If you lost 5% of your body weight, you pretty much gained it all back. If you lost 10% of your body weight, you pretty much gained it all back in a year. And so again, if you lose enough weight, it may just take another year for all that weight to come back, or it is possible that there is some durable weight loss of, you know, maybe a third if you're talking really big numbers of amount of weight lost. So I think that's a huge, huge caveat for people thinking, hey, I'm just going to take this drug for 6 months and then lose some weight, get my beach body, and then I'll be set. I think at least the data that's been published is pretty clear that weight regain is expected, not necessarily an unusual phenomenon. So I think that's one important piece of the weight regain picture after it. In terms of, you know, titrating people off of it, what I tell everybody is it's up to you. It is not an essential medication for you to be alive on. And so some people feel like, hey, I don't want to be on this anymore. I've been on this for a while. It helped do what I wanted to do, but I don't want to take it anymore. And so again, this is a discussion I'd have with your provider of, is the right thing for you to do? What we typically do with our patients is we will slowly titrate them down and monitor their weight over a handful of months. So if you're at the max dose and you hit a plateau or you get to the weight, you're happy with it, we basically just back down slowly and see what happens to your weight. There is going to be some rebound. So we are going to expect you to gain some weight back. We don't want you to gain all the weight back, but we want it to sort of be that sort of gentle process of adjusting it down, seeing what happens, adjusting it down, seeing what happens. And if they get to the point where they're like, hey, I want to stop it completely, we're totally supportive of that. Again, I think coming back to that set point theory, the goal when we're giving these drugs is really to help people change their lives. So I think the one reason I do think they're helpful is because they make people's behavior change much, much easier. When you're not hungry all the time, it's much easier to choose healthier options. Many of the patients finally can lose enough weight that they're not in pain to exercise. So again, I think for some people, it actually gives them the ability to do the things that we're trying to work on that they actually couldn't do before. So if they've done that successfully and they've implemented a bunch of dietary changes alongside the medication and they've been able to start a physical activity program, I think you have a really good chance where your weight is not going to fly back up to where it was before. But I think anybody who goes on the medication doesn't necessarily have the commensurate lifestyle changes, goes off of the medication. I mean, I basically say you're probably going to regain all that weight because nothing has changed, right? We took away the one thing that was lowering your set point down. Now it is possible, maybe if we keep your set point low enough for maybe 2 years or 3 years or 4 years, it actually truly resets and actually does not change. But I think everything that we've seen in the short term is that you have to not just make the changes once, you have to make a permanent change if you want to have permanent weight loss that comes with it. The analogy that I try and give with people, which hopefully I think is helpful, is if you think of any other chronic condition like high blood pressure or high cholesterol or diabetes, when you come into the doctor's office and they says, hey, your blood pressure's high, we're going to start you on a blood pressure pill or two. We give you the medication and say, hey, take this. And then we remeasure it. Oh, good. Your blood pressure's down. Great. Here's refills for the next year. And here's the refills for the next 20 years because you're going to stay on that blood pressure medication to keep it at the new place that it was. And so I think for some reason, oftentimes we viewed weight differently in that it is this static thing that you just have to get to some magical number and it's all of a sudden going to take care of itself when it really is a chronic condition that is going to require some type of chronic management that doesn't have to be medications, but it can be medications. And I think, again, the more of the lifestyle things and the more underlying things you can correct that go into that equation, the better off you're going to be and the less likely you're going to be reliant on it. But they are approved for lifelong use. So I think we're going to have a number of patients who will be taking this for the long haul.
That's a very helpful analogy, John. I think all chronic diseases, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, are partly medication managed, partly lifestyle and behaviorally managed. And viewing it in that context takes away so much of the stigma around how we manage obesity differently than these other chronic conditions. So I think that's a perfect analogy. Well, John, thank you so much. This is a tremendous amount of information and your depth and understanding of the science behind it and your experience with patients and weight loss is really just brilliant and stellar. So thank you for the tremendous amount of information you've packed into this conversation.
Sure. It's been my pleasure. Can I make one last comment?
Absolutely.
I'm just going to put on my public health hat here for just a few moments because, I mean, I spend much of my time in the trenches working one-on-one with patients. But I mean, one of a beautiful quote I heard, which I wish we could sort of spread more broadly, is when a flower doesn't bloom, you fix the environment in which it grows, not the flower itself. So I feel like I spend most of my days fixing individual flowers when the reality is the environments we live in are not as controllable as we'd like them to be. We focus a lot on behavior change. It is not an easy thing to do, but I think we really have created an environment around us that makes losing weight and keeping it off incredibly difficult. And so I think acknowledging that, one, I think as a society, that's a much larger decision we have to make to say, hey, we want healthy food to be cheap and accessible to everybody. We don't want people to have ultra processed, I'll use the word garbage, available all the time at basically no cost. And we want to inspire people to be physically active, have good social relationships, get enough sleep, not be distracted, and really get to enjoy life. So as much as we spend so much time and money and energy in healthcare and things like these medications, but I think there are huge societal problems that if we invested a fraction of this amount of money, I think we could really change the whole world to the point where we really wouldn't need Wegovy other than for a handful of patients. If you look at, I mean, Novo Nordisk, they made $22 billion last year of profit. $22 billion. And if I think about how much we're struggling for like after school programs or PE in classrooms and just access to healthy foods, it blows my mind that semaglutide for the cost is about $800,000 a month when you're paying out of pocket. We could literally buy everyone who's taking it a Peloton bike, give them a prescription for a year, give them pick your favorite meal service plan all month. We could cover all of their food and we could basically bring a gym to their house for the same price as the drug. And so it just gets lost in healthcare because healthcare is just so, so expensive. But I think when we actually sit down and think about how much money we are spending, it is crazy to think that we couldn't invest that and do something better with it.
That is such a great perspective to end on. And thank you for raising the issue of cost and how we could invest it in different ways and at a societal level to really look at how we allocate our resources.
Yeah, and I have no affiliation with any of those companies. It was just a fun example. But yeah, I think that would be something that I think would be wonderful because I think a rising tide lifts all ships. And rather than medicate individual people, I would love to see us medicate the whole society in a way that is sustainable and really does improve, you know, the things that matter most to us.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Well, John, thank you so much. This has been such a great conversation. And yeah, thank you. It's very much enjoyed it.
It was a pleasure talking with you, Sharon, as always. Happy to come back anytime.
Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode and share it with a friend. Until next time, do something to help improve your whole health naturally.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the views or positions of any entities they represent.